This is Cab Class with Gary, Mark and Sean. And we're asking, are you a classy cabbie or a dirty old dog? If you think you're a classy cabbie, maybe you have a story to tell and you don't mind us digging out your past, then get in touch by emailing us at newcabclass@gmail.com. Gotta love it. That's Cab Class with Gary, Mark and Sean.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Cab Class, the brand new podcast where we interview your favourite cab drivers. We'll find out a bit about their history and of course if they're a classy cabbie or a dirty dog. Thank you everyone for listening, we appreciate every listener. The feedback keeps coming in, it's getting better and better every week. We really appreciate everyone who gives us all this positive feedback, has been excellent. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at London Taxi Radio so you can get all the videos sent to you. You ain't got a faff about looking for them. Anyway, that's enough of that. I'm Gary, one of your hosts. Next to me is my old mucker, the Silver Fox. He laughs at his own jokes. Chelsea Mark.
How you going?
How's it going, mate?
All right, mate, yeah. Don't talk about football this week.
No,
please.
We don't
football. Can't do football.
No, we done football last week.
We've got a black armband on. We lost Frank.
You was like a dog with two tails last week talking about football.
Since we started this podcast thing, Chelsea have just gone downhill like Franz Glamour. Right. Like, what's going on?
I know, you tried to call him sick, I weren't having it.
I've done it, it's mad, isn't it? And then, you keep bringing in supporters who have got like a new album out. Bring us a Millwall fan. We want an ugly Millwall fan and not just like
we
talking
need an
about
Orient
football.
Fan.
Yeah, an Orient fan, we could pick on him. But all of a sudden, you keep going, oh, this is an Oscar fan. Oh, here comes a West Ham fan. Here comes.
Yep.
No, I don't know. Don't do it to me, mate.
How you been this week?
All right, mate. I went to work yesterday for the first time in ages, and it ain't easy, mate, is it?
No.
God almighty.
So I've worked sitting in doors. I'll be honest, the walls are closing in a bit in doors. The kids, I love them to death, but they're driving me potty. Yeah. I've got the cat and dog. They follow me round the house. It's like the animals at War Memorial. I'm going a bit bonkers.
I've got three animals. It's like a zoo in my house. It's mad. And because of lockdown, they've become really needy. They can't believe you're at home all the time. So, they're doing your head in.
But we've had some good news this week. And I'm sure the man who puts this all together, the man who sorts out the checks, the man who bounces them around, Sean Paul Day, can you tell us a bit about this great news we've had this week?
Well, it'd be unbecoming of me, wouldn't it, if I didn't actually mention the resounding success of last week's High Court case. I know there's been one or two anti-taxi zealots making themselves busy in their basements, but we can't take away, can we, the absolutely remarkable success of that ruling. And it is their most comprehensive, conclusive and damning victory against TfL's flawed policies, transport policies. I mean, we've got to say that, I know it's a bit bleak out there at the moment, isn't it? And people are having a hard time. But nevertheless, this ruling really does reinstate us as being integrated into public transport. Yeah. It really does solidify our special status as taxi drivers. That is what we've wanted for such a long time. And I think just to come, when everything was at its bleakest last week, when people didn't think there was a way forward, couldn't see a way ahead, and especially that's been compounded on by lockdown, hasn't it? And yet you have this result that has firmly come through on the side of taxi drivers. And it's not before time, really, is it? And
so I think it's such a damning verdict from the judge. It's like you wrote it. It was just unbelievable, wasn't it? It's amazing. In every way, she smashed them out of court and made them look...
And we were speaking about it the day before. Well, was a little bit, fingers crossed, but it never goes our way, so it probably won't this time. And then, wallet.
She didn't just go our way. She went our way big time.
Oh, big time. I mean, conclusively and scathingly on TfL and the fact that they haven't put in due process in coming to the conclusion with all these street space schemes. So I think it's a brilliant result for the cab trade. And I've got to say this, if they choose to appeal, they choose to respond, and they've already got to appeal to the judge who's denied them an appeal, so they've got to get over that obstacle. But if they do choose to appeal, then really, I mean, this could be an absolutely PR car crash for them.
Yeah.
Because they are going to be persecutory and prejudicial against the most vulnerable in the community.
Yeah.
And so we would say that...
And with the taxpayers' pay.
And with our money as well. Yeah. And so we would say, don't waste people's money, don't waste public funds on appealing this. What you've got to do is be inclusive and get rid of the persecution, get rid of the prejudice, and actually, maybe there's a way ahead.
I think Sean has finally earned his keeping, eh? We've had him here all 5 weeks and he's finally
I know I would say this because he's standing here with me, but he just says what I want to hear. He's brilliant. Sean, you're the best mouthpiece in the cab trade by none, and I mean that. And he knows I love him to death, but it is. And what you just said is brilliant, and I'm so pleased for the cab trade and for you in particular that the work you put in. And it is, and I mean that as well.
A special shout out for UTAG and
everybody who has supported UTAG in this. Yeah. I mean, it's a gift for all of them. And like I say, things are hard at the moment, so we're not going to see instantaneous results. No. But nevertheless, hold in there because there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, I appreciate it, mate.
Cab Class with Gary, Mark, and Sean. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Now, it's been a great week, and it's about to get better. Now, a few people, it's an hour long, I let me listen to it for an hour. Well, I'm going to let you know, this one could be a little bit longer, because we've got a man who's got plenty to say. He's been great, we're so happy to have him here. He's come all the way down, out of the goodness of his heart. Please, I'd love to introduce Tony Walker.
Tony Walker.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Pleasure to be here.
Tony, thanks for coming, mate.
You're more than welcome.
But this isn't just Tony Walker, this is the Tony Walker.
The Tony Walker. My head is swelling, I won't be able to get out of cab.
great to meet you. How feel as I know you, because I've seen so much of you on telly, and especially preparing for this. And honestly, mate, it's where do we start?
Well, we can leave now, if I'm honest, we can show up.
I've met him for an hour before this, and we're in for a treat, because it's old on your rat's time, isn't it?
We're going to have nothing to talk about somewhere. He's warming up, mate.
I've thrown me notes over my shoulder. We're going live.
Well, we're going to hand it over to you, Tone. We'd love to hear a bit about where you're from, your sort of pre-cab life, really, where you went from growing up right up until knowledge days. You've got so much to say, and we'll just sit back and enjoy.
I was born and bred in Bethnal Green.
Born at Bethnal.
And my dad was a free card trickster, which was in them days, you know, orange box free cards on a sort of box and going up the West End with his little gang.
A bit like the ones on Westminster Bridge now.
Yeah, them ones, but rather than little peas and a little bowl, my dad had free cards. And
Did he teach you that?
Well, I know how to do it, yes, very much so. And my mum, she always liked to drink, and she was always in the pub. But the best thing about it is we were left to our own devices as kids. And being Bethnal Green, the nearest park was Vicky Park, Victoria Park. And when the fun fair came, and you know, the park and the swings and everything, by the time I was 5 and 6, I had a streetwise education. And my first ever job was in a fruit shop in Bishop's Way. And from there, next door to the fruit shop, I used to get, in them days, was 2 bob a week, helping the old lady who owned it, putting the all the potatoes up on the shelves and filling all the oranges and the apples on their shelves, you know, made a nice display. But next door there was a pub where my mum always used to go into, and in them days you had shire horses with a drayman, you know, delivering the beer from the cellar.
Oh, is that how they used to do it? Yeah,
that's it. And they used to turn up with these mammoth shire horses. Yeah. And I used to have these cooking apples living right next door, working in the fruit shop.
Tony, I don't want to give your age away, but what period of time are we talking about here?
63.
Right.
1963, 62.
So you're talking, you were 6.
Yes, that's my first ever job.
So at 6 you had a job?
Yeah, absolutely.
I even heard Tottenham had a decent side there.
No, they didn't.
From there...
I can't get that in my head. It sounds Victorian. At the age of 6...
Well, I was a street urchin without question, and Artful Dodger type. I'd done my apprenticeship on the street.
So you stole his apples to give the horses, did you?
Well, I didn't steal them. They were all the ones who had specs on them. It was, you know, on the way out. And Mary Chandler, the lady who owned the shop, she said, go on, give the horses the apples. And it was like a house, this horse, the two horses, they had nameplates on. And I was all sort of shy and tentative. But as soon as I put that first apple in that mouth and I had an affinity straight away with the horse.
There, yeah?
And by the time I was 7 and 8, a friend of ours from the flats at that time, because we moved to Waterloo Gardens, they were going to horse riding up in Dagenham, which from Bethnal Green to Dagenham as a kid of 8 years old, it's in the country.
Yeah, I've said this before, funnily enough, on a different pod.
Even Leytonstone was in the country from Bethnal Green in them days. And from there, they put me on a little Shetland pony, and the affinity I had straight away with that pony, I'll never forget Sherry, the horse's name, they say at Rumpist in them days, but going back to that, it was straight away I knew I had an affinity with horses.
So then what happened at the age of seven? Did this TV company come along? Did they approach your school or did they approach your family?
No, they approached the school, and then in them days you had Paul Armand, who was the director, and Tim Ewart. He was Australian, one was Canadian, and they didn't understand the class system in England at that particular time. And you had a researcher there by the name of Michael Apted, who was looking for diversity and children from one end of the social scale to the other end of the social scale. They already picked the three wise men, the three sort of Kensington boys who were singing Waltzing Matilda in Latin
at the reading the FT.
Reading the Times.
But they wanted the Artful Dodger type at the other end of the scale. And
who was that then?
My school teacher pointed me out with my girlfriend, I love you, she loves me type of thing. Kiss chasing in them days, that's what it was. And the four of us, because there was two boys, two girls, picked out. And we got took to somewhere in West London at the time, Shepherd's Bush, I think. They had a studio there, and they had a play park, and they had an adventure playground. And the next day was a Saturday. They took us to Saturday Morning Pictures. In them days, it was sort of Captain Marvel, Looney Tunes. Yeah. And
We actually see this, didn't we, on the
show? Old Mother Riley, great days. And it was sixpence to get in. Your mum used to say, go on, go with your mates, it's sixpence, sort of get rid of it on a Saturday morning.
What was the show called, Tony, now? At this stage, your first ever show was called...
7 Up.
Was called 7 Up.
7 Up.
So it didn't... But the idea of it being every 7 years hasn't taken off yet, is that correct?
No, I will come to that later on. And so the preface was, give me a child until he's seven, I will show you the man. So it went out after JFK got assassinated. That was when we got the filming done. And in April of 64, when there was a boom of music, you had fashion, Mary Quant, you had Twiggy, you had the Beatles,
yeah,
you had, there was an explosion of culture. And you had World in Action at the time, which was a groundbreaking documentary program, and it was shown on that. And it just set a light to the whole of what England stood for at that particular time. You had the Thems and you had the Husses, and you had most of all the poverty and the rich. And it was an unbelievable...
like a social experiment.
Yeah, and it was an insight in what was going on in England at that particular time.
I mean, Tony, did it start off as a social experiment, or was it just about tracking people throughout their lives
never,
every 7 years?
The concept was never, ever there that it was going to track people. It was just going to be a one-off. Right. Now, in the meantime, you had Paul Armand, the director, went back to Canada to make films. Tim Ewart went back to Australia. And Michael acted after 7 years. He done 29 Coronation Streets, and he made his bones in Granada TV with Sidney Bernstein being the head of the Edon show there at that time. And in 1969, you had a guy called Derek Foreman, one of the head guys there. Michael was a right... You know, he was predominantly successful then, doing Coronation Street directing and various other productions there. And Derek Foreman said, Michael, he said, I wonder how them kids are getting on. You know, you filmed 7 years ago.
Just jumping back, Tom. So did you have any idea what was going on at 7 years old? You were just taken somewhere.
Oblivious.
Was your family paid?
My mum got £10 in them days, which I never saw a penny. But £10...
You had a job already, though.
You know, they bought a couple of bottles of scotches, and my dad probably had the other in the betting shop. That's how, you know...
Yeah. Where he was completely oblivious to
oblivious,
it.
And I never
did. Did you at seven have any say in it? I mean, no. So you were sort of like, tap on the shoulder... Do it, and I know you're only seven, but that was it. You were chosen. You were going to do.
And also, was you coached at all?
No.
Not trained in a way, but did you feel, looking back, you probably won't remember, was they feeding you what they wanted you to say?
No, never. Oblivious. Yeah. Completely oblivious. What's going to happen? I was just an excitable kid, and you know, no less than everyone else.
Yeah.
But the only thing I had more than probably the other kid was more poverty.
Yeah.
You know, my mum and dad were what I would consider less responsible now. But they loved us. I got the love more and respect for my mum and dad. I love more than anything, even now. You know.
But what comes across to me, Tony, is how streetwise you looked, even at that age, compared to the others. You know, I know we're talking about a class system and the different spectrums, but you come across as someone older than seven, as a, I mean, a little bit cheeky, a little bit, but that, yeah, which was after the appeal, but it did, it looked to me like almost that you were chosen because of who you were, weren't you?
Yeah, probably. You was, yeah, you know, the deprivation was there, and my ass was hanging out my trousers, and I mean, you know, snotty nosed kid. Of course, you know, they wanted a parody from one end of the social scale to the other social scale, and when you saw it, actually visualise it on the TV, then it was more of an explosive situation rather than, you know, it ain't in a book here. Cool, you can see what's happening.
How much of it did you understand at the time? Did they let you leave you to yourself to do what you wanted to do? Was you aware that you was being filmed?
There was no coercion at all. You was just blatantly there in your face. What you was at that particular time, whether they liked it or not, it stayed.
Yeah. Did all the kids get on?
Well, it was funny. I'll never forget. It was a little 7-Up bottle of lemonade type of thing, and we had cakes, and I've never ever had a party, and you had the monotone singing, if you say that you love me, like a Mersey group, you know, singing these sort of 60 songs, and it resonated with me then, you know, dancing and whatever, and I was pushing them out the way, they were pushing me out the way, until one time that I stood no more at seven, I sort of hit him and bashed him in the back, and when Andrew, he actually got on camera, he said, how did you like them young kids from the East End? He said, they're a bit too rough for my liking.
And he was right, wasn't he?
They hit me in the back, and I've still got the pain there.
And that's when the three of them sitting there chatting. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
Lovely guys. And I must say, I picked John Brisby up, the very nonchalant one. I picked him up in my cab from Heathrow, and still friends with him today.
Yeah, he's the barrister, yeah?
Gentleman. Yeah. And I took him home, and there we were in his house, silver salver, China cups, having cups of tea, talking about his career. He's asking me how I'm getting on, being a cabbie and that. And I thought, if Michael Apted could get us now, just as the man in the street and man doing his job, taking him to his house, well, I think, you know.
I mean, that's really interesting. Nice. What? I mean, I've been hooked on this since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I absolutely love the idea and the concept of it. How much of it has affected your life? Because I know there's one or two that felt that they were, it was dictating what they was doing in life.
Yeah.
Was it like that with you?
Sean, I can only speak for myself. When Michael Apted does come every 7 years, I say, you got a template there. You got a clear page. You do or say whatever you like. Ask me any questions. I've got no inhibitions to say, you know, I'm embarrassed of that. Or, you know, what it is on that particular time of 7 years. And there's no thinking, oh, I'm going to be successful, I'm going to have money, I'm going to have this, or I'm going to do that for the general public to see. It was never like that, and it was never a pill that I had to swallow to say I don't want to be in an embarrassing situation. Waltz as well, if I'm in an adverse situation, then let the camera see it, because why? It happens to everybody in the world. You all live, you all die, you all smile, you all sad, you all get happy. And at the end of the day, you lose parents, you divorce, some people do, and it happens what life has got to offer, that everyone experiences the ups and downs.
And how many of you are left now doing it?
Well, sadly, Lynn died, who I've met many occasions, and I picked her up as well in my taxi, believe it or not. And I think there's 11 of us left now.
Do they do anything in between the 7 years? Do they contact you, or is it literally back a year before, or whatever? How does it work?
They do the research about 2 months before, and they ask us what's happening in your life. But obviously, Michael's got to have notes to sort of find out what's going on. I.e., in this case, a grandson was born, my Alpha, from my daughter. She had another baby. Then I lost a house in Spain. From the 7 years before, because the economical crash, it left us high and dry, my wife and I, out there, and there wasn't enough to pay the bill. So it was everything happened, you know, new governments, Blair, then you have, you know, you had a Labour government, then you'll have a Conservative government. In one case, Lady Diana sadly died. Then in this case, it was Brexit. So there's all sort of topics and news items that are very sort of, you know, historic, that's going to sort of be an idea what year you're in, if you know what I'm saying.
I'll tell you one great clip. I was watching, I was sitting down with my missus, we was watching 28 Up, and you're sitting with your wife at the table, and you're having a chat, and we're sitting there, and you could almost feel the tension between you two.
That was 35
Up. 35 Up, I do beg your pardon. And we were sitting there, and you're saying, they look like they've just had a row and then they've pulled it together to sit at that table.
The situation there was, I was talking about Magaluf, and we go there with all the boys and the golfers every year, and I've been going there for 30...
I see, Cassie gets the guy away.
Yeah, 35 years I've been going there, probably nearly 40, and, you know, and every year, it's like a jolly up week, it's fantastic, and I look forward to it, so
she
didn't like me going, but, you know, without being, or coming across male chauvinistic, which it isn't, it was just... You know, I think I worked hard enough to get a deserved holiday here.
The reason I brought it up
without the wife.
The reason I brought it up is just to show what you were saying, how natural it is, and no airs and graces, warts and all, as Cromwell said.
I can only speak on my behalf, there's no warts and all. What they do to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're going to go back in time. Is it fault your career as a jockey? Was that between 14 and 28?
Well, when I was 14, my dad used to know a guy called Snowy Buckingham. He was a masseur. And in them days, the jockeys had a top masseur to lose weight, hence the...
What's a masseur?
A masseur.
A masseuse.
I thought a massager.
I thought it was underground, a masseur.
Am I right? Am I saying a masseur?
Well, I've been to a few masseuses in my time.
You call it a masseur?
We call that one different.
Right, if I'm wrong, excuse my ignorance. It was a masseuse. We'll go your line. And the situation was, he was a masseuse to all the jockeys. And my dad always knew I wanted to be a jockey. And this Snowy Buckingham knew Tommy Gosling, who, where you live, in Burheath Road, by Ashton, is he had his stables, Prime Lodge. And I wrote to him as a 14-year-old, still at school, and he said, well, come down, we're going to try and turn you into an apprentice jockey. I couldn't wait to get there, coming from Bethnal Green, snotty-nosed sort of kid.
Yeah. Surprised we let you in.
From there, I got to Epsom, and straight away, they all... took the corners off of my discipline. I was sort of yes or no, so three flags for, plus the love of the horses and the affinity I had immediately, and I had to muck out every day. And I went 2 weeks holiday at Christmas time from school, and I got up every day at 6 o'clock.
I was living there
on the yard, and it was serendipity for me, beautiful. And then I will turn 15 in 1970. And I was leaving schools in the Easter, and immediately I knew I was going to be a jockey. And all the careers officers in them days gave all the kids their opportunity to do whether they want to be carpenters or electricians, etc. And I said, no, it's no good me speaking to you, Governor. I said, I'm going to Epsom, and I knew my fate was...
It's not really, Bethnal Green isn't really a jockey area, is it?
No. Yeah,
you've got to be the first jockey to come out of Bethnal Green.
When you think my brother was a docker, my sister worked as a telephonist, my other brother was in and out of whatever, Scally. And, you know, I thought, no, I want to be a jockey.
And you sounded like a great grounding.
It was a great grounding.
Did the show have any idea on it? I know that the great quote in the show is, I want to be a jockey, but it wasn't, you weren't doing this because you knew this show was now...
I told you that before.
What I'm thinking, at the age of 14 you said you did this, which happens to be the next show. So that wasn't in your brain thinking, this gives me a story from the show.
I can imagine you paid very little part of your life.
I never even knew they were going to come the second time. No one did.
Right,
until Michael Apted got the authorization from
but this would have been about the mid 70s.
No, 1970.
Not 1970 when you had been. So this is a great time for jockeys as well, isn't it? 1970.
Well, I mean, you can imagine. I knew. I opened up the paper. I could read it like the alphabet. I got a very good memory, as you appreciate. I knew every jockey. I knew who the stables they worked for. I knew all the lads who worked for the stables. There was about 14 stables in Epsom at that time. Four apprentices to a stable at the time, and I knew every one of them. We used to meet, and the camaraderie there was second to none.
So now you're there, you're working there, but you're still not a jockey. So how hard is that transition to actually then become a jockey? So it's like a semi-pro footballer they're making it.
And what does it take to make it as a jockey?
Well, first and foremost, dedication, 100%, morning, noon and night. A horse would never know it's Christmas Day. You have to work Christmas days. You've got to look after them horses. You've got to have a passion for horses and a passion for the animal. And you've got to be disciplined, and you've got to be regimental in your own way. You've got to get up at half five every morning. You've got to muck out. you've got to groom the horses, you've got to put the saddle on, then you come back in the afternoon for evening stables, starts at 4 o'clock, then you have to feed the horses, then you've got to groom them again, then any horses has got a runny nose, you've got to report to the head lad, you know, you've got to lift the towel up, see any discharge of any horse or anything, and you've got to monitor the horses that you're looking
and
after.
You've got to take care of yourself, I'm sure.
Well, the weight in them days, I was only 6.5 stone, which was, I never even thought about it, you know.
You
I was a kid, didn't have to. But I then come out of racing because I had a bad experience with the head lad. We had a bad argument. I was only a kid, 6.5. So he hit me over the back with a shovel. Ooh. And my crime was going to his allotment and treading on his bulbs or whatever they were. I don't know, couldn't be, and it all caved in. And he got a shovel and smashed me over the back with it. Nearly broke me back. And
that's how the feudal system works.
Well, that's how it was, truthfully. Yeah. So I went out the game and I had a word with the old man, and my dad said, come, we go second helpings here. I went back to Langley Vale, where Jackie Sirrett, my other trainer, was. He said, I'm going to give you a month's trial. If you're any good, I'll sign you on. If you're not, you know, go back to London. I was there 2 weeks, and he called me in the office. He said, here's your apprentice form, sign them.
Best day of your life?
I'm getting emotional here because I'm thinking of meeting mum and dad. And what happens is, he says to me, you know, we'll give you a chance. So I didn't know at the time he was 68 years old and it was his last season as a trainer. But I signed these with great excitement. And within 3 weeks after signing, he called me into the office. He said, as your weight, son, by this time I've gone up to 7'10". So I said, oh, okay, always yes sir, no sir, I'm doing all right. There was never negativity. You're always going to be up. Even if you was down, you have to say you're up. I said, I'm fit as a flea, sir. You know, I can do the weight, no problem, sir, yeah. He said, I need to tell you, he said, we got a ride for you on Kempton on Friday. Well, you could have knocked me down with a feather.
That's the only growl, wasn't it?
It is the only growl, but the best is yet to come, because I phoned my mum up and I said to me dad, who's a punter, he's in the betting shop every day. I said, dad, the governor said I'm riding at Kempton. He said, when? I said, Kempton, Friday, be there, get the cameras there, get some photos. My brother turned up, so the big day came. And I'm looking at the race tomorrow, and I can see Leicester on tomorrow's runners, and I can see Leicester Piggott's in the same race.
Yeah, that's unreal, isn't it?
That's unreal. The Lionel Messi of racing. Yeah. And your
Lionel Messi and George Best all in one.
Like you lining up with Glenn Hoddle.
Well, you can imagine. I mean, I go in, that big day came, and he took me there in his car, the governor, and he said, go on, son, be changed and be ready an hour before the race. So I go in there and there's all valets. They all got valets, jockeys. And at number one peg was Leicester's peg. Then you go all forward. You had like Willie Carson, number two, or Pat Edwin, number three, seniority, and you know. And I was shipped right to the very end. And at the other end, I'm looking. He's like, it's. And he's just there reading a Sporting Life, just as though it's like a matter of fact. And there am I, pumping with my heart, knowing that I've got to go out there, and you get a bell. Ding.
Did you think you had a chance for the horses on?
No, my old Chateau d'If it's called, and if it's French, it's House of Death. Chateau d'If. And it had three legs and a swinger. Yeah, it had come back from being fired on its fetlock. And we had boots on it, which, you know, give it support. And the parade ring bell goes ding, 3 minutes, jockeys, get ready. So you put your helmets on, you look in the mirror, do I look all right? The valet gives me silks and says to me, you look swell, Tony, away you go, son, don't worry, break a leg type of thing. If you only knew about the horse.
He shouldn't have said it to the horse as well.
Well, we get into the parade ring and I look up and see me mum and
bless
my dad and so proud, but I've looked up and I can see my name on the boards, A. Walker, Anthony Walker, hence Tony, and about 400 L. Piggott, and there was no cameras in them days as far as iPhones. I wish my brother would have took that photo, and it was like a dream. You're floating on air, and you hear the bell go, well, the jockeys get mounted, please, ding, ding, and you get up on your horse, and there's the crowd, and you can hear the humming, and then you can hear it, and I'm now got me reins, I've got me straps on me levers, and ready to go high, and I'm all ready, and the governor says, go on, you know what to do. I said, yes, sir, and I counted out into the parade, we're onto the course, we go down.
Was that a machine gun?
Yeah, that's the horses' ooze. We get to the we get to the start, and we're meddling around in the start, and the starter says your stall numbers. They give the odd numbers first, the even numbers second, and he sort of said Walker 6, stall number 6,
yeah.
Piggott 10, or whatever, and you're like, oh my god, same name, same sentence, same hero. And the best thing is
loving it, yeah.
The stalls opened up. I come out about third, I come out good, but my orders were keep to that growl, and I was outside, and I was a bit apprehensive, but it made no difference, like an echo, you're just in your zone, and away we went.
And what are you, when you're riding, obviously I've never ridden horse, most of us ain't, when you're racing, what are you, are you just focusing on what's in front of you?
You're dead, you're completely...
You're
in that moment, are completely dedicated to what you're doing, 100%. You know, you're going 35 miles an hour going to a bend on
a
horse.
We've got to paint a small picture. Most of us don't ride horses, and to race them, you paint a picture, you can see the other people in the corner of your eye, but you're not taking no notice.
What you're not seeing, and all the people are watching this from afar, is the verbal that's going on in the race.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There's a lot of that. Yeah.
There's a lot of swearing. There's a lot of jockeying for position. Get over, leave it out, go over, you know, and swearing whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, it's intimidating, but you've got to stay on your ground. You know, that's my ground. That's my bit of thing. You know. Yeah.
And are you hyper aware of where you are in the race?
I wasn't at that time. I was so inexperienced.
Well, that was so far ahead.
And you know, that's the camera. As we turn in the bend, I'm holding my position, and all of a sudden, it was like a puncher. I felt a puncher on the fetlock.
Someone's hit you.
The horse's leg started.
Oh, sorry.
And you know, it sort of not broke down at the time, but you know.
Only no one puncher.
And it went slower and slower, and I thought, I've got to get the cigar out. It was like a mannequin advert. All I could see going further away was the arses of the other jockeys and the horses.
You won the race after.
I did win the race after. If you reverse it. But that wasn't the idea. The idea was, I've done it.
And
it was the greatest moment of my life, as you know.
With all what you've done, that's the greatest moment. So that's what an accolade, what a day. Yeah, I mean, you've been done, but you've done numerous things. And brilliant.
Yeah, I could see you got quite emotional there, but what a memory to be able to recall that in such detail.
Well, I mean, you know, I ain't playing football over the marshes with your mates in a pub, you know, and you think, I wish I could play with Messi, or I could play with Maradona.
You can compare it to all different fields. You can say, well, it's like being in a race with Lewis Hamilton. It's like playing on the same field with Jimmy Greaves.
Yeah, the top person.
You're the top in your... of the scale in that profession.
So what happened, Tony, then? So right now you're a jockey. So where...
Apprentice
Right, why did it not push on? What happened?
Well, after 3 years in Epsom, which I had, my governor now was at the latter part of his career. He gave us 2 months' notice that he's going to retire by the end of the season, which was now November time. And in them days, you had 4 to 5 apprentices in sort of like 10 yards, all around 14 yards around Epsom. And Epsom was my home. I knew every corner. I knew everything about, you know, all the yards. I knew all the boys. And if I would have gone back to another yard, where I was only apprentice at my stable, I would have had 18 months to get where I was. And not only that, if there's 4 good apprentices, which they were,
You'd have been in the back of the queue.
I would have been back of the queue, and the work ethics, of course, would have took me another 18 months to get where I should have been. Not in a conceited way.
Yeah.
I mean, I already worked for that, but it's like he's there before me, so he's sort of naturally he's going to go first. Yeah. That's how I perceived it. I could be wrong now, but good horses make good jockeys, and I never rode good horses.
Yeah.
But it's a great experience. And the discipline I learned, it cut the corners off my character of being yes or no, sir, free bags.
What I am taking from a lot of this, obviously, riding with Lester Pig is the major thing, but the grounding he's gave you as a person.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic.
Sounds brilliant.
When you see servicemen come out of the army, or you see November the 8th when they walk down that mall, you know, their chests out, yeah, and they're, you know, they're one of the boys, like, you know, the camaraderie with all that. It is no less than how I've perceived it when being in Epsom in the 70s as becoming an apprentice jockey. I would honestly say the apprentices all love one another. That's how I...
Except the one who clumped you with a shovel.
No, he wasn't. He was a head lad. And if I like to see him today on a walking stick. And I'm not really a wicked man.
Just don't have cabbages in your allotment.
I don't like talking about him because he's a bad
man. It was such a great story. We don't end on a bad note. So, where do we now find the cab driving? Where do we find the knowledge? You've come away from the job. Did you do a few bits in between, or was it straight into the knowledge?
Then I went... From 72 I worked at William Hills, I come out at 73 the stable.
Yeah.
Then I went down Hackneywick Dog Track, because I worked at William Hills before that.
Right.
Then I went into the dog track with all the bookmakers running around as a bookies runner.
Was you like a point his ear, point
yeah,
his
I can do
nose,
all that. I can do tick
tweet his nipple.
I can do all that. I can do tick
tack. I'll go to the dot and I'll just watch them.
Well, look, if you go look, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 6. 5 and 1 is 6.
Yes, don't work great with radio.
£10.
Right.
I respect that.
It's doing it now.
Right. So I can do tips.
Honestly, that's brilliant.
Did you used to get loads of good tips and all that? Or was that all part of it?
They always give you a good tip. Look left and right when crossing the road.
Oh, yeah. Don't eat yellow.
Don't eat yellow that way. But then I was learning the bookmaking. I used to run to Hackneywick Dogs. I was having hundreds of pounds on for the punter. Now, if the punter won, I'd probably get 10% off him. And if the bookmaker won off the punter, I'd get 10% off him. So I was the middleman, earning money.
Like a
bugger. But you must understand, by this time it was 76, well, we're moving on. I've got two brothers who are cabbies now.
Oh, okay.
They were cabbies. Four uncles who were cabbies.
Right. It's in the blood.
My wife's a cabbie now. Three nephews who are cabbie, plus my sister's a cabbie. So I got on the knowledge in 76.
And that's more than the amount of cabbies working now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
That's it.
Well, just the walkers out there.
Yeah. Where do you live in the feeder park?
No. We're nothing like that. And we don't talk shop. I make sure of it go home.
I can
nothing
imagine. Worse, yeah.
You know, you can imagine me making love with my wife. Leave on the left end of the bed. Forward the bed, spread. Yeah, go on. But you know, and then from there, I got on an under 50 bike. My brother helped me, of course. My brother Joey got out in 77, yeah. Queen's Jubilee.
Of course, we see you on the show. You did look rather dapper. Did you dress up that day?
What, leather jacket? James Dean? Yeah. No, not at all.
I see that red coat you wore. I think it might have been 28.
Well, I was James Dean.
Please tell me you ain't still got that.
Because in them days, I read books and books and books about James Dean, and I thought, yes, I could do that. And
They meant before the crash, though, didn't they?
Yeah, before the crash, yeah. I like that one. But going back to... In 76, I went up. Yeah. I wanted to be a film extra, and I went up to the Film Arts Association in Marlow.
Doing this at the same time,
yeah,
as the knowledge.
On the knowledge. Then I done that. Then I got me FAA card. I shot down to Lexington Street Central Casting, filled it in. What type of guy you are in them days? Fair hair, blue eyed, short, 5 foot, whatever. Bandy legs and whatever. Then as I registered for that, I gone from. Running around in the Hackneywick Dogs, the phone rang one day, no mobiles in them days, said, Tony, got a job for you on the Sweeney. The Sweeney.
No,
so if ever you see it, the series called Visiting Firemen, they pay me £12 to run around Battersea Park in a tracksuit with the old Bill chasing us. I'll never forget that one.
You're used to that, weren't you?
Yeah.
Wasn't really method acting.
No, that wasn't method acting. Yeah, I tell you, that was fantastic. No, then I got paid £12 cash. Then, you know, I've done the knowledge and I got out in...
Did you get through the knowledge well? Was you liked? Yeah, so I got, did they
No, I had them back? All. I had Mr. Finley, who was fantastic, but shit scared, absolute terrified of the man. And I'll never forget, he said some street in... There was two streets the same name, and I gave him the one in Araby Street end, and he gave me he wanted the one in New Kings Road end, and he said, Mr. Walker, stop changing the questions. And I looked, I was terrified. I was terrified of the man. But
did they know you? You like knowing you're going there, going, oh, this is the kiddie on telly?
No. There was no preferential treatment either, as you know.
No, it might have gone the other way though.
No, but yeah. But they no. I knew it from my brothers, and they told me, stum and crumb, yeah. sit down on that yeah. seat. Don't sit down and
speak when you're spoken.
Speak when you're spoken. I knew all the rules. And,
but all the jockey stuff must have come in good stead for your yes sir, no sir stuff.
Sitting down on the seat, absolutely. Yeah. But going back,
that's a great point, because I know a few lads who didn't make it because they didn't know how to do the yes sir, no sir.
You've got
sir.
To do that. And there's no shortcuts ever. So I went out on my bike. I'd done my knowledge, which I've got a very good repetitive memory. I've got a good head for streets. And I knew all the little apples go quickly, please. Yeah, and I knew the terrible 10. Yeah, and they're like, you do, then you do it all.
And it moved to Penton Street at that time.
No, it was at Penton Street. It was 1979, I got my bill. And Mr. Miller,
Mr. Miller
gave me my bill.
So you're the one who earned all the money.
No, and I'll never forget what he done to me. He gave me 5 suburbs, airport to Staines, airport to Richmond, airport to somewhere else, wherever. Then he says to me, King's Cross Station to South Mimms
Services.
Yeah, yeah. I said, I don't know, sir. He said, right, what's the time? He went like that. He said, I'm going to lunch. He said, come back after lunch. I'll come back at 2 o'clock or whatever. And by that time, I run in the Knowledge Corner Cafe. I went South Mimms, King's Cross to South Mimms. Give me the run. I got the run. I knew it parrot fashion. Shot straight back in. Sat down like a little choir boy. He said, did you learn it, Mr. Walker? I said, yes, sir. Leave on the left of King's Cross, forward Midland Road, straight up Holloway Archway, A1, and there you are, whatever. He said, okay. I had it all ready for you, he said. I said, oh, thank you, he said. Have you got 15p? It was 15p in them days. And 2 photos, you know. Yeah. You had to have 2 new ones.
Yeah.
I said, yes, sir, I got them.
He'd done it there and then.
And I'll never forget.
Well, could you walk out and drive a cab?
Yeah, I went straight down to BJ's, Brian Glassman, whose son now is Colts cab. Michael. And his dad, I said, because I had a Wangle cab for 6 months. And,
no idea.
A Wangle cab is, he'd give you, sign a contract, he'd give you a cab that you have to have for 3 or 4 months before you're a cabbie. So you learn, in them days, it was a manual. Big heavy, sort of like a tank.
I had absolutely no idea.
2.5. And I shot down there. He said, make sure you pay your rent, Tony. I said, don't worry. I'll never forget JMC 687K. It was a manual. And it had a steering wheel like a tank.
A manual cab, can you imagine?
Oh, I got on it, Johnny the Butter. I went straight down to the 2 Bells Owen Square, Pimlico Road. My 2 brothers there. I've gone in, shiny badge
around
there.
Yeah, as you do.
There man, I am. Look at me. Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, all the boys.
You're like Trigger when he's got the thing and he's pointing his chest at
I've never done a job. Then all of a sudden, my brother Johnny said, well done. Said, I'll have egg and chips down to you, whatever it was, you know. So I've done that. We got out in Owen Square. I put my light on and a woman come up to me. I'll never forget the job. Hyde Park Gardens, please. Yes, sir. In them days, it was 30p clock, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I put the clock on. We get to Hyde Park Gardens. Now, I've got to give me first job away. It came to £3.20, and I had to give it away, which I did. Like we all do. And I thought, yes, I've done it. And that was that. Terrified at the first beginning.
How old was you? 20?
I was the youngest one to get my bill in my generation at that time, and my group. I was 23.
That's young.
23.
That's young.
Yeah, young to be a cab driver.
Yeah, I was just basically. Really no, 22. I tell you, my birthday September. I got out May. So I was 22 and 7 months.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you what, not many 23-year-olds could do and pass out the knowledge because you're still a bit immature, blah, blah. So I reckon a lot of that. Coming from the stables and that life you led has then gave you the ability to be able to do the knowledge
at
that
plus,
age.
Don't forget all my family, my uncles, my brothers, they were calling me
over
most
you're
days.
You're still down to you, aren't it? You're still not going out with your mates
on the
piss.
I didn't mind the knowledge. I mean, you know, you sit down like we all. In various things. I mean, I didn't like it over Dulwich and when it's pissing down the rain. Yeah. And, you know, hiding in a cafe with your sort of hands behind a sort of cup of bottle.
I never forget being in Greenwich, it was like -5 and I sat behind my moped and let the exhaust walk. Me up. And I wanted to cry for myself. I was like, what am I doing?
I'm better than this.
I went down Holloway Road one day and the car door opened, my handlebar hit the car door and I'd done a somersault over and the bike sort of coming towards me and you know that was scary.
But I remember when it was really freezing, I used to know all the public conveniences, all the toilets that had hand heaters, you know what I mean? Yeah. Everybody thought I was loitering, but I wasn't. I was actually warming my hands under the heaters.
As long as you only warm your hands.
As long as George Michael wasn't there welcoming
him. How ironic, though, that a jockey fell off his bike.
It was a door handle of another car.
Oh, that old chestnut. You should have stayed to the rails. You've got to stay close in.
So then I went off from there and bought my first cab off my brother-in-law. WYE 564S.
You've got a memory.
Madness, isn't it? You remember these things. But even now I can remember runs in my head and, you know, things.
Do you still enjoy being a cab driver?
Not pandemic out of the way and before, but you still enjoy it?
To me, the cab driver is either work or an adventure. Mm-hmm. I've done the adventure lark for the first 7 years. It was an adventure. But then when the penny dropped, it became a work. You know, it seemed to change, and different people were coming into the trade. You know, for the latter years, the camaraderie's gone out the trade.
I think a lot of that camaraderie's gone because of social media and the fact that we all we connect in different ways now. Whereas before, you didn't have a mobile, so you'd say to your pals, "Right, we'll meet at this rank at this time, we'll have a cup of tea and a chat." Whereas now, you're on WhatsApp.
Yeah, but in them days, you had the Granby Grill, you had the Green Badge Club, you had Midland Road. Everywhere had their own sort of places up, you know, where you eat at night, and it was great, you know.
Yeah, different times.
And then everyone's got a story to say. Have a guess who I picked up tonight.
Well, they got a story in with you
there. Have a guess who I picked up tonight. You wouldn't believe it. Some piss artist. He's only left his wallet in the cab. What do I do? I found 200 quid in it. What do I do? Give him back? All these type of things. Yeah. And of course, you do give it back.
I love to see it when you drive past the green hut and you say, sorry. I say old boys because they're older than me, and they're having a rabbit, and you think, that's how it used to be, you know, pre-smart.
Well, I've been to them all. I've been to the All Nations in Kensington there. I've been to the one up in Pembridge Road there in Notting Hill Gate, that one. And if you go Hanover Square, and if you go to Savoy at the back there in the old Howard Hotel.
If only they could make a decent cup of coffee.
Yeah, but you go in them there, I'll tell you what, they're like Doctor Who TARDISes.
They are,
you go in there, there's about 10 people round. It's fantastic.
My builder mates come to me, "Gal, what are they like inside?" I said, "I'm unreal. Sauna."
You want to go downstairs?
They got a pool table downstairs.
Yeah, but you know. The fantastic,
they don't know, it's just a bench
and the people who give you the cups of tea, it's a proper cup of tea. You have afters, you have a jam roll and custard,
but you
it's
know,
proper.
Us,
you
but
know.
Us in Bethnal Green, we don't drink instant, we're lattes.
No, we've got Pleacher's Cap.
Yes, please.
Do you know there's only 13 green nuts left? There's 13 and they're listed.
The thing is, though, it takes a bit of while to get into the green nuts because you have to feel a bit qualified, don't you, before you go knocking on the door to see if they'll let you in. Can be a bit clicky
I agree with you there, but I mean, you've got to have a bit of troubleshooting about you. You know, you've got to have a characteristics. I won't be intimidated with anyone.
I can't see anything intimidating you.
Definitely not.
I wouldn't go in if you was in there.
Okay. Walking out laughing.
Now, Tony, I don't know whether you've got a knack for it. I don't really recognise them, but you seem to have had more celebrities in your cab.
Yeah.
Is that just by chance, or do you scour them out? Do you look for them?
There's
Tom Jones.
I've had 43 years of driving a cab, and I can go from Alf Garnett to, as I say, Tom Jones, Joan Collins. I could go Johnny Depp, Robert Downey Jr. I could go on. Lester Pigott, I picked up my hero.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
On my mother's grave.
Did you say he was number six?
No. I'll go in...
Was he surprised you'd finish that, mate?
You've got to listen. I was in Deanery Street, where I'm a regular, in Chandler's quite often enough. Chandler's betting shop. I used to come in. Lester was always in there. I got talking to him.
Brilliant.
And one day he said, Tony, can you take me up to the Baker Street? I said, certainly.
Did he have a mask on?
No.
Oh, that's
blinding. And I got there at 3 o'clock, and there he is looking out the window waiting for me. And I took him up to Baker Street there, and he was with his wife. He had to meet who was buying curtains. And he said thank you, but he never paid me a penny. Never paid me one penny. Not that I would have took
you. No, but he would have been nice to me, Tom.
And I asked him, I asked him who's the best horse he ever rode.
Yeah.
My favourite horse was Nijinsky, of course, at them days. But he said Survivor. That was his favourite horse. And I was just picking brains with him. He was the genius of all time on the turf. Best won't be beaten.
Yeah.
Right. I'm gutted. I speaking to Tony beforehand, he's got so much to say.
We're going to have to revisit Tony.
I think we're going to have to do a part two because we've got to get on to a little game we play at the end of each episode, right? And it's called Are You a Classy Cabbie or Are You a Dirty Dog? Now, I don't think you're a dirty dog.
No. I'm old school and
old school class. No school like the old school. Tony's the
I've done a lot of things driving a cab, I can assure you, and I mean I've never been an angel. But at the end of the day,
none of us are.
The principles are between absolutely the brethren, and I wouldn't come out of that.
Right. So what we're going to do, we're going to ask you a couple of questions each, and we would like you to answer them openly and honestly, and we'll score you. But it's all a bit of fun. It's not too well. Right. So I'll start off with a question. Okay, you've had a touch. Someone's asked you a terminal 2 Heathrow.
Yeah.
You pull up, you get them out. Now, do you sit there and muck around the fire? And, oh, let me just let's get that rubbish out. Let me just sweep the back out to see if someone comes up and wants a job away.
Oh, I've done that many a time.
You're on the way to being a dirty dog, you know.
And it's called opportunist theft. That's what you'd call it.
Yeah.
Or it's he's only going there anyway. It can't do no harm. I told you, I have done it, and sometimes I've regretted it because I've had my collar felt doing it.
Yeah, you got a tag here.
Yeah, in them days, a guy called Cyborgs, he used to wait for cabbies. That was his nickname, and all the Brussels out there, all the Brussels sprats out there, the tats, they all knew him.
Yeah.
And his name was Neil. That was his surname, and he used to wait for cabbies to do that.
Yeah.
And he'd have even a disguise. But what they done one day, the mini cabs, they found out where he lived. And they got Ballast, a firm near Hanslow.
Right.
They phoned up, they had a collection between the drivers, and it come to about 30 quid that they wanted Ballast delivered to their house. So it's like all this sort of Ballast was on this back of a lorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And they delivered it outside his drive. So when he came home, he couldn't get into his ass.
Oh, that's
and that's
fantastic.
What the minicab's done to him.
Oh,
that's a true story.
That's great.
But Cyborgs used to come in disguise. What, he shaved his cyborgs off?
That was his name. And he was renowned for nicking cab drivers. So I was one unfortunate enough to have my collar felt by him. But as I say, I was young and naive in them days. And that's it.
Yep.
Right, then I've got a question. Have you ever drove off with someone's change?
No, in fact.
I can
reverse that.
No, because 17 years ago, I know the exact date.
Yeah.
I got in your cab.
Yeah.
This is a true story, and one of my pals recognised you, so we had a right laugh. You
did
were quite.
Did you really get in my cab?
On my mother's eyesight.
Yeah.
Anyway, and it was so, you were brilliant. You were like a comedy act. Anyway, I've gone to pay because I'm the cab driver. It was something like 8:20, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway. I gave you a tenner and you went, I want to be a jockey, and you drove off.
No!
and you had us on the floor laughing. It was so funny. It was a classic. Now listen, it's not the principle, it's the money.
Yeah, the one.
Why did you do that?
180 in 10 years is your number.
And that's why I've done this show. Yeah. You owe me 180. Yeah.
All right, well, I can better that. I picked Boris Johnson up at the time, who was mayor of London.
Yeah.
About 8 years ago.
You should have joked the BGA. Oh,
this is a true story, and I put it up on Twitter on various occasions. He come out of Downing Street wearing that bubble hat he used to wear to sort of make him less distinguished with his blonde hair.
Yeah.
I thought, it's Boris Johnson, the mayor. Where are we going, sir? Could you take me to the Ritz, please, he said. We get to the Ritz, it comes to 8.80 or whatever. There was an odd 80p. He gives me the 8 quid and he says, excuse me, tapping his pockets, I haven't got 80p on me. And he walked away into the Ritz. Every time I see Mr. Johnson now, as Prime Minister now, I look at him and say, sir, you owe me 80p.
It's
true story.
I always say, you want to know the richest brilliant man in the pub is the one not up the bar.
It's the probably up there with the publican's wife.
Oh, he would be, Johnson, yeah. I've had a few passengers tell me a few
that's
stories
a great story.
All right, let's move on to another one. Someone jumps in your cab and they say, cool, ain't it a nice cab? I normally get an Uber.
What is your response? Oh. Do you give them a lot of stick, or do you think, I'll say, turn the charm on?
Don't mention a four-letter word with a U in it in my camp.
Yes.
That's what I always say. I said, you get what you pay for. If you mention that again, you're going to go pay a double fare.
And all in good spirits.
In good spirits, of course.
There's nothing worse than getting these cameras, because I told them, right?
No, no. Yeah. At the end of the day, you know, don't wipe your feet when you go out, because you already got shit on your shoes by getting in the first place.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Well done. Right.
It's a good answer.
Have you ever broomed a job from point? Front of the rank?
I probably have. No. There's two ways of looking at this. If they're unsavoury characters, or I can tell them in a polite way,
that's
to
a pass,
go off ski, I would very politely suggest, sir, not this one.
Yeah.
But as far as being on a rank, Cumberland, wherever, A to B, bread and butter jobs, of course, forward march we go.
You're right in front of Liverpool Street, they want to go to Middlesex Street.
I've done it hundreds of times. Yeah, done it hundreds of times.
Tick.
Have you ever overestimated a job just because you didn't want it? Have you ever had someone out of damn, mate, how much would you go to and you think you ain't getting in here, so you just
got a good question.
You hit it with three figures and they go, whoa, I'm getting in there.
That's a good question.
I'm an East London boy. If they want to go East Ham, I can say, yeah, no problem, jump in. If they want to go to Streatham, I'll go, oh, mate, you're really good. Go try the one beyond. If
you
I'm
get
working,
a bus pass for 80p.
If I'm bread and butter working, as in when the punter comes up, they are your bread and butter. I'll go and do it, of course.
Yeah, that's a very good answer. Yeah, there's nothing worse than you seconding and he's not
taking them.
Think, just take them, mate. Like, it swings a man to bats.
Yeah.
Oh, they're the worst. Right, I think this is a pet aim for a lot of cabbies, and I'm seeing it quite a lot, not in a minute, but pre-pandemic. Them ones, they want to squeeze on the back of the rank, but their arses are hanging out.
Yeah.
And they're blocking the buses. I think we know Orchard Street, that bit for Selfridges is murder. Are you one of them? Do you hang up the back and block the road?
I do it occasionally at Mandarin Hotel.
Mandarin.
That's a two cab rank.
Up on the curb?
Yeah. I hit that one.
Yeah.
That's
you're not blocking traffic there.
No, that's about... I'm not really a ranking cab.
No, me neither.
Right? I'm here there.
Not an old ranker.
No. Thank God you're not drinking. But going back to that, I mean, I probably failed a rank on various occasions.
Yeah, I'm
no different from anybody else.
We all overrank now at nine, but don't cause people problems. You're making us all look
You've only got to look at Harrods rank, and that's a typical example. You go from there, and that is really a piss take. You know what I saw the other day?
I can't believe
in
that,
pandemic situation?
Yeah. Back to Walton Street.
Worse. Marrowbone High Street. But on the corner,
there's a
Waitrose or whatever.
Yeah.
They were coming back through nearly Mandeville Place.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was if you never see it, you would never have believed it.
Well, I'm out there every day, I'm seeing it. And I don't have a point of over. Listen, you've got to do what you do to get a job, but don't impede other traffic. If you're gonna, swerve it, move on. Right. Okay, we got any more? I think we're done. I couldn't call this man a dirty dog.
No. Even if he was.
No, he's not. He's not.
No,
he's the same with us. He takes a chance.
Even the Spurs thing, I could have gone the dirty dog way, but...
And he's from Bethnal Green, you know he's good stock. And he's managed to make it out, which means he's got some intelligence, unlike me.
And we've only really tapped the surface of his fame and how big his show is.
I would love to come back. One is Sean, who's the most eloquent London cabbie in town.
He's fantastic.
He beats the drum for us. Yeah. He does everything for the trade. And I won't get my tongue any higher, Sean, but I can assure you...
I didn't quite hear what you were saying.
There is no one better with your support and eloquence when you come out with your reports to the media.
Well,
you are fantastic.
True story.
Thank you very much.
And you two boys, again, you beat the drum for the London cab trade, which everyone does. Appreciate you both.
Thank you very much.
And at the end of the day, there's no mendacity here on my behalf to you boys. I will tell it how it is, and most of all, I will thank you for your endeavours towards the black cab.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Great way to end it. Absolutely blinding person.
This is Cab Class with Gary, Mark, and Sean. And we're asking, are you a classy cabbie or a dirty old dog?
If you think you're a classy cabbie, maybe you have a story to tell and you don't mind us digging out your past, then get in touch by emailing us at newcabclass@gmail.com. Gotta love it. That's Cab Class with Gary, Mark and Sean.